Dr. Jennifer Toler-Eroskin, who is an assistant professor at the UNC Greensboro. She received her MPH and PhD from UCLA School of Public Health. She was a pre-doctoral fellow at the California Center for Population Research and the UCLA AIDS Research Training Program, and a Duke Global Health Institute pre-doctoral fellow. Her research focuses on the intersection of gender, poverty, and health from a structural perspective.
Of course, I need to start by saying that I have no relationships to disclose. And the work that I'm going to talk about today was funded by Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation through their Avahan India AIDS Initiative. The work I'm going to talk about is in India. India is third in the world in number of people living with HIV. Now, its population prevalence is less than 1%. It's about 0.3%. But having such a large population, there are over 2.1 million people living with HIV in India. In India, the spread of HIV is concentrated in four high-risk groups: female sex workers, injection drug users, men who have sex with men, and then bridge populations, which would include sex worker clients and truckers. In 2003, the Gates Foundation, through their Avahan India AIDS Initiative, pledged $200 million to combat HIV/AIDS in India. And then in 2007, they contributed an additional $58 million. Avahan was focused on the six highest prevalence states and then the four core high-risk groups. It ended up funding 130 non-governmental organizations, and that ended up covering 220,000 female sex workers across the country. The work I'm talking about today is evaluation results from Project Parivartan, which analyzed a community-led structural intervention for female sex workers in two districts in the state of Andhra Pradesh. Beginning in 2004, the intervention was implemented by a local NGO, and it recently transitioned into full Indian ownership and oversight. In fact, later this month, there's a big celebration about the transition to local Indian oversight. And so, recalling, Avahan funded 130 NGOs. I'm talking about the work done by one of those NGOs. Now, the state of Andhra Pradesh is down there in the southeast part of India. It's made up of 23 districts, which we might consider counties or municipalities. And Project Parivartan worked in two of those districts, Guntur and East Godavari. The overall conceptual model for this intervention was focused on three domains: creating an enabling environment, improving community mobilization, and improving control over and access to healthcare services. And the idea was that by improving in these three domains would increase female sex workers' rights and reduce their risk for HIV. There were multiple strategies for each of the domains, and so today I'm just talking about the police advocacy component. As part of the police component, female sex workers were recruited and trained to be social change agents. They were peer educators and community organizers. So that in their role as community change agents, they did lots of things, not entirely focused on police and police work, but they were trained in dealing with police problems. And then the police advocacy efforts began with the NGO holding sensitization meetings with the local police officials. And I should take a second here to mention that in India and in the state of Andhra Pradesh, female sex work is not illegal. But every activity that needs to happen in order for the exchange of sex and money to happen is illegal. So the exchange itself is not. And that sort of ambiguous legal status gives police a lot of leeway in deciding, are they going to arrest a sex worker or a pimp? Are they going to harass them, give them a hard time? It's really up to them. Most sex workers in Andhra Pradesh, when they're arrested under the public nuisance law. So the goal of the sensitization meetings was to, first of all, establish the NGO's credentials. Look, we're here, we're legitimate, we're working with sex workers. They wanted to challenge the stigma associated with sex work, in part by showing that sex workers could organize and come together and be a valid organization with a voice that needed to be heard. And then, of course, the sensitization meetings included a discussion of how police could be part of the solution with regard to HIV prevention. About midway through the funded period, there were a series of police abuses reported by female sex workers, and so the intervention decided to create a crisis intervention team, and that was made up of social change agents, so female sex workers themselves, lawyers, human rights activists, politicians, and members of the media. The approach was meant to empower female sex workers with collective action and legal literacy to let sex workers know about their rights, what needed to happen in an arrest, even if they were at fault and their arrest was legitimate. They had certain rights that could and needed to be respected. The crisis intervention team also had a rapid response team that was meant to influence the police. So if a sex worker was arrested, she could get in touch with a rapid response team, and within 24 hours, she would have a team of advocates on her side helping her through the process. And the teams were meant to encourage female sex workers to file court cases if they were arrested, fined, or solicited for bribes. So for this study, I really wanted to assess the prevalence of certain negative police interactions as reported by the female sex workers, look at the associations between these police interactions and three HIV outcomes, and those are sexually transmitted disease symptoms, inconsistent condom use with clients, and acceptance of more money for sex without a condom. And finally, I wanted to determine whether any of those associations changed over time. The data that I'm using are from three rounds of a cross-sectional survey we did. It used respondent-driven sampling as a strategy to reach this very hidden population. The first round was done in 2006, and we can consider that at the very, very initial stages of the police advocacy component of the intervention. Second round was done in 2007, and that was still, I would say, the initial stages of police advocacy work. And then the third round, 2009-2010, was when the police component was well underway. To be in the survey, women had to be 18 years or older and have exchanged sex for money in the past year. And then for the analysis that I did, I restricted it further to female sex workers who had worked in the past week, and that's because of the condom measure that I used, and having no missing on any of my study variables. So I end up with a sample of over 2,000 women. Here are some demographic characteristics. There's a lot of data here, and to improve the readability, there's not a lot of substantive change across time, so I'm going to focus just on the total there. So women are about 32 years old. They have, on average, about 10 clients in a week. So if you're familiar with sex work in other contexts, that might be a difference. They typically started sex work when they were already adults, somewhere between 18 and 29 years old. 75% are not able to read, and more than 80% are in debt. So we have a lot of work out of our team about what literacy and debt, how that relates to entry into sex work and continued sex work. And then with regard to the venue that they're working in, the majority were home or agricultural, were working in home or agricultural-based settings. This is not a heavily institutionalized brothel-based sample. And many of the women worked in multiple venues. Now looking at the primary independent variables that I'm interested in, the negative police interactions as reported by the female sex workers. Overall, it's a pattern of decline over time across from round one to round three. So again, these are reported by the female sex workers. Having had sex with a police officer so that she could avoid trouble starting about 13% in round one, goes down to 11% by round three, 2009-2010. Having a police rate of workplace goes from about 43% down to 27%, and being arrested goes from about 19% to 12%. So, and all of these were significant drops over time. Now, the outcomes of interest. This result here is STI symptoms by survey round. These are having reported any of six sexually transmitted disease symptoms in the past, having experienced them in the past 6 months. And so this is sort of all over the place, different proportions and in different rounds. This may be related to the increase in access to services and awareness of women that what they were experiencing can be considered an STI symptom. Inconsistent condom use is dropping over time, which we can't attribute by any means just to the police component. This is a multi-component intervention, but that was a positive for us. So inconsistent condom use with any client dropping from 44% to 25% over time. And similarly, acceptance of more money for sex without a condom is dropping from 25% in round one to 18% in round three. So the pattern we're seeing just with descriptives is the negative police interactions are reducing over time. The HIV risk-related outcomes also reducing over time. But what's the relationship between the two? So this table shows the association of each of the police-related interactions with STI symptoms. And the adjusted odds ratios are in the far right column there. And so what this is saying, for example, is that for women who had reported having sex with a police officer to avoid trouble, they had more than 2.5 times the odds of experiencing STI symptoms. And if it helps to interpret, I have there the percentage among the exposed and percentage among the unexposed. So among women who had sex with a police officer to avoid trouble, 70% reported STI symptoms, compared with women who didn't report sex with a police officer, 64%. And you see some of those are pretty dramatic differences. Here we have the results for inconsistent condom use with clients. For this one, the only statistically significant associations were with police taking a bribe or gift so that the sex worker could avoid trouble and having the police taking condoms away. And then for acceptance for more money for sex without a condom, all of those were statistically significant. And again, the particularly strong one you see there, police taking condoms away, for women who experienced that, they were more than 3 times, almost 4 times as likely to be willing to accept sex, accept more money for sex without a condom. And then over time, with regard to STI symptoms, the associations did not change over time. They were consistent across rounds. For consistent condom use, the association between police taking condoms away and consistent condom use, and the association between being arrested and consistent condom use, both got stronger over survey rounds. So the overall levels are reducing, but the association is getting stronger. And similarly, for the association between being arrested and accepting more money for sex without a condom, it got stronger over survey rounds. So what is this telling us? Well, police abuses of female sex workers are highly prevalent in this setting. And again, I told you that this setting, it has an ambiguous legal status. And it makes it difficult for both police and sex workers. In the context of our multi-component intervention that included police advocacy, there has been a decline in specific types of negative police interactions with sex workers. But when these abuses occurred, they remain highly significant with women's vulnerability to HIV. We know that the ambiguous legality of sex work in other settings puts female sex workers at risk for violence and other abuse at the hands of police and the hands of clients. If they're trying to avoid police, they're probably going to more remote, more hidden locations and putting themselves at risk for violence by clients. I think this also calls into question, is police sensitization useful? So we're putting a lot of effort into making the interactions be nicer. Does that matter? Maybe the interactions themselves between police and sex workers have such a power dynamic that even if they're nice interactions, they still relate to affect women's risk for HIV. And I think we need serious consideration of the pros and cons of legalization of sex work if we're thinking about strategies to reduce violence, victimization, and HIV risk for female sex workers. And here I have some critical questions. If we're talking legalization, does that mean regulation? And sometimes regulation of sex work may involve some of the same power dynamics that put women at risk in the first place. There's some argument that female sex workers may be in need of police protection from clients, from pimps, or from other people. And if so, maybe legalization wouldn't be the best strategy. And there are a number of organizations concerned with whether legalization of sex work negatively impacts police's ability to investigate other crimes, such as human trafficking or the drug trade. And so I'm looking forward to questions from you all when we get done about what the implications of the study are. Thank you.